ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय श्रीशुक उवाच हंस एव प्रसन्नाभ्याम् विशुद्धं प्रतिभाषितः देवकी वासुदेवाभ्याम् अनुज्ञातो विशद्गृहम्।
Shukadev Goswami continued, "Thus having been addressed in purity by Devaki and Vasudev, who were very much appeased, Kamsa felt pleased, and with their permission he entered his home. Tasyam ratriyam yatithayam Kamsa ahuya mantrinaha Tebya achasta tat sarvam yad uktam yoga nidraya." After that night passed, Kamsa summoned his ministers and informed them of all that had been spoken by Yogamaya, who had revealed that he who was to slay Kamsa had already been born somewhere else. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The Vedic scripture Chandi describes Maya, the energy of the Supreme Lord, as Nidra. Durga Devi Sarvabhuteshu Nidra Rupena Samastita. The energy of Yoga Maya and Mahamaya keeps the living entity sleeping in this material world in the darkness of ignorance. Yoga Maya, the goddess Durga, kept Kamsa in darkness about Krishna's birth and misled him to believe that his enemy Krishna had been born somewhere else. Krishna was born as the son of Devaki, but according to the Lord's original plan, as prophesied to Brahma, he went to Vrindavan to give pleasure to Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj and other intimate friends and devotees for 11 years. Then he would return to kill Kamsa. Because Kamsa did not know this, he believed Yogamaya's statement that Krishna was born elsewhere, not of Devaki. This morning we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 4, entitled "The Atrocities of King Kamsa." Texts 28 and 29. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells, Prakrite kriyamana ni gunai karmani sarvasha ahankarma vimudatma kartaham iti manyate. That due to bewilderment covered by Maya, one thinks oneself the doer of activity. Ahankar, the very root of material bondage and suffering,
the false ego, gives us this misconception that I am this body. Those things in relation to the body are mine, and I am the doer of my activities. The nature of this world is the more we identify with the things we have, the more we become entangled. The illusion of Maya is very simple to understand theoretically, but very difficult to resist if we are entangled. That is, that the illusion that I will be liberated from anxieties, from sufferings, from fear, according to what I can do and what I have. But in actuality, the more we could do and the more we have deepens the bondage and entanglement if we think that I am the doer, that I am the proprietor, or that I am the enjoyer. Bhoktaram jagatapasam sarvaloka maheshwaro suhridam sarvabhutanam gyatva mam shantim richchati. If we want peace, Krishna tells us, this is the formula. To understand that Krishna is the proprietor of everything that exists. Nothing is mine. That Krishna is the controller of all controllers. I am ultimately controlled. And that Krishna is the best well-wishing friend and benefactor of everyone. And we trust him. Then we can find actual peace. But to the degree we are infected by the fever of the misconception that I am the proprietor, I am the controller, or I am the benefactor, the ahankar entangles us in such a way that we perpetually suffer birth after birth after birth. And we become infatuated, even obsessed with these misconceived identities, with the false promise that by pursuing them, they will liberate me. It's so obvious philosophically. But Maya means to cover over like a veil where the most obvious things we cannot see. And even if we see, we don't see. Kamsa is such a symbolic example which the Vedic histories have given us. He thought he was the controller. He thought he was the proprietor. He was the prince, the son of Maharaj Ugrasena and Padma, his mother. The riches, the influence that he had were incredible. But he wanted more. He wanted to have a greater sense of security that I'm not only the prince, the eldest son of my father. Immediately, he couldn't wait. He couldn't wait for his father to naturally get old and go to the forest or die. He wanted it now, immediately. He had to have these powers. So he put his father in prison, afraid for his life. He was going to kill his own sister. And ultimately, what he considered to be very merciful, he didn't kill her. But he cast his sister and brother-in-law, who were his loving well-wishers, who wanted nothing but the best for him. He put them in prison. He murdered their babies 6 consecutively in fear. There was no question of peace of mind or happiness any time during all those years. He was in constant fear and constantly plotting and scheming to somehow or other liberate himself from this fear. The problem is he wanted to be the controller. But he wasn't. Nobody's the controller except Ishvara Parama Krishna. Krishna is the supreme controller. The jivatma has a little bit of independence, and therefore we have some degree where we can control things. But ultimately, 24 hours a day, for all eternity, we are controlled. Controlled either by the internal energy, Yogamaya, or the external energy, Mahamaya. But we're always under the control of Krishna. Frustrated by our inability to find real satisfaction controlling the resources of material existence, sometimes people take to the path of spirituality. Time, Krishna reveals to us in Bhagavad Gita, is his form, which is controlling everything within the manifestation of this cosmos. The sun is in the process of burning out. The oceans will evaporate. The earth will disappear. And our bodies, when a baby starts growing from the perception of the mother and father, the baby's getting bigger and learning to walk, learning to talk, going to school. But from the perspective of time, the baby's just getting old, that's all. Just at a different stage. From the perception of the soul, we may think that the grandmother is older than the granddaughter. Only this shell. But, unless we're liberated, it's a cycle. In one sense, the grandmother is actually closer in time to being a newborn baby. So from the perspective of looking back, the teenage granddaughter is young. But if you look forward, the grandmother's younger. Because she's about to be a baby. And the teenage daughter's about to be a grandmother. This is how time works. But time is controlling everything and everyone on this physical platform. And on a subtle level, Maya controls us by keeping us attached to something. Attached to our bodies, attached to our family members, attached to our possessions, attached to our prestige, attached to our skills, our intelligence, our abilities. And the attachment of Maya is we think this is mine. But the liberated state is not, according to Rupa Goswami, Yukta Vairagya. The liberated state doesn't necessarily mean to give these things up. It means to give up the misconception that I am this body and these things belong to me. Yes, Kamsa, like everyone in this world, whether we're in the mode of ignorance, passion, or goodness, Kamsa was struggling to hold on to what he had and struggling to enjoy in the process, thinking himself to be the proprietor. Sometimes when we try to give a person an logical understanding of who we are, we ask, do you say I body or do you say my body? Obviously, my body. Nobody says I body. When you go to the doctor and you have a broken arm, you don't say, please take an x-ray of I arm. You say, take my arm. So this is just the logical understanding that I am not the body, but the body is mine. But from a deeper spiritual level, even that's an illusion. Because the body's not yours. Proprietorship means control. If it was your body, your arm wouldn't break. You would just say, arm, don't break. But it breaks. You would say, body, don't get old. Now, you could say it now and think, well, I'm still the way I am. But time has its own ways. You're getting old. So it's neither I body, nor is it actually my body. It's Krishna's body. So when you go to the hospital, please take an x-ray of Krishna's arm. But that brings in another potential illusion. Then you start thinking, I am Krishna. Which means I am the controller. And this is what happens. We become frustrated being controlled by a higher power, so we think liberation is to be the supreme controller. To give up this bodily conception, to give up all sense of proprietorship over anything, and realize, Aham Brahmasmi, I am God. But the problem for that is God never comes under illusion. Mamayavam, Mayaya, Krishna tells in Gita, that I am the controller of this material nature. He's the controller of all controllers. This Maya is his energy, and working under his direction. God never falls in Maya. Maya is his instrument. But we, struggling and striving to somehow or other be liberated from suffering, we keep falling into the very traps of the person who's making us suffer. Just like the fish in the water wants to enjoy, and the fisherman knows the weakness of the fish. And I don't know how much you have studied fishermen. I haven't, but I understand at least this much, that a good fisherman knows what fish they want to catch. And they know how to catch them. Just like if you want to catch a shark, you don't put a little fish at the end of a hook this big. But if you want to catch a bass, then you put a fish this big. If you want to catch a shark, you put a bass at the end of it. He's that big. So we know, a fisherman knows, this is the kind of fish that this other fish likes to eat. Very expert. So Maya also, according to our particular mode of nature, she knows what it is that will entice us, what it will that is that will infatuate us. And Maya sends us those things to entangle us, to bewilder us, to keep us covered. Birth after birth, trying to find liberation from suffering through the very things that make us suffer. It's like if you're sick because you take too much milk. Prabhupada said the cure is yogurt, dahi. But if you don't understand that, if you're sick because of too much milk, you keep drinking more and more milk, thinking it will make me better. But it will not make us better. It will perpetuate the illness, make it worse and worse and worse. And that is Kamsa. He's so afraid of losing what he has. And please understand, he had a lot to lose. His physical body, each of his arms, had the strength of 10,000 elephants. And these are Dwapara Yuga elephants. One Dwapara Yuga elephant probably had the strength of 10,000 Kali Yuga elephants. Can you imagine his strength? He's very powerful. And he didn't get that power by watching television. He got that power through severe austerities. For hundreds and hundreds of years, he earned those powers. He attained those powers. So he worked and worked and suffered intensely to achieve those powers. And now he has a body with all those powers. Can you imagine how much he's attached to that body? He invested so much into it. If you have 50 rupees in a bank account and the bank closes, it's not terrible. But if your whole life savings of 50 crores of rupees are in that bank account and the bank closes, it's a disaster. It's
So Kamsa worked so hard. He invested so much, the major portion of his life, in getting the physical and emotional and mental powers that he had. How much he feared death, that he would lose all that. If a person gets a PhD, or two PhDs, if a person gets yogic mystical powers, if a person works hard and gains tremendous wealth and a beautiful home and a wonderful family, the nature of the material world, it only increases our attachment. And along with that attachment comes a greater and greater fear of losing it. Which means fear of death. And death is inevitable for everyone. Whether you're Kamsa or Indra or the Indragopa, the little insect, or the little microscopic personality that's within your cell, just swarming around, doesn't know who he is or where he's going. Death comes. Vajahure mana srinandanandana abhayat sharanaravindare. But if we just take shelter of Krishna, we can become fearless. What does it mean to take shelter of Krishna? It's something very practical. It means to actually, in the core of our heart, admit that nothing is mine. Everything is Krishna's. Krishna is the controller of all controllers. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he had this consciousness and he expressed it in his beautiful prayers. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he had incredible intelligence. He was a magistrate in the British courts, very, very highly respected, honored, awarded. He had several homes. He had a home in Godramdweep and Navadweep. He had a home in Calcutta, the Bhakti Bhavan. He had a home in Puri. He had an ancestral home in Orissa. He had at least 10 children. 10 children. It's a lot to be attached to. He was also had such a brilliant capacity to write songs and melodies and prayers, and he had so much fame. The British government adored him. The saints and sadhus and Paramhamsa Babaji's adored him. The scholars and academia adored him. The common village people adored him. Everyone adored him. Of course, there's always people who are envious and everything like that. That's part of this world. He had everything. Manaso deho geho jo kichu mor arpilun tu aupade nanda kishore. Said Krishna, my body, my mind, my property, my family, everything is yours, O Nanda Kishore. It is all your property. Maro birako bi jo icha toha. My Lord, if you want to protect me, you can protect me. If you want to kill me, I'll gladly be killed. You have every right to do anything you want with me because I am your servant. Nadanam na janam na sundarim kabitam va jagadish kamaye mama janmani janmani shvari bhavatad bhaktirohayate kidvari.
This beautiful song that Bhakti Vinod sang is a very practical living example of this verse by Lord Chaitanya. I do not want wealth or sensory enjoyment or fame or even liberation. I just want to serve you unconditionally. What does that mean? That everything I have is yours, my Lord. Srila Prabhupada developed that concept in his prayers. Or he said, I am your puppet. If you want to give me the words to speak to attract these people's hearts, then you can give me the words. Otherwise, I cannot do it. I'm just your puppet. Kamsa, he wanted everyone to be his puppets. Whatever he said was the authority. And the more power he got, the more attached and entangled he became. The more property and money he achieved, the more he feared death. Because all this hard work, the fruits, the results would all be taken away. And why? Why did he work so hard to get these mystical yogic powers? To put his own father in prison. To put his own brother and sister in prison. To conquer land after land after land and make alliances with people who actually hated him. Just to get more power. It was all to secure the illusion that anything belonged to him. It was based on fear. Fear is the cause of bondage. Bhakti teaches us the opposite. That we accept that everything belongs to Krishna, and what we do it in devotion to Krishna. Therefore, there's no attachment. There's no fear. And there's no suffering. Krishna, this is your body. Whenever you want to put me in another body, I'm yours. It's not a problem. Krishna, this is your family. This is your property. If you want them in somewhere else, or if you want to give them to somebody else, it's yours. I'm your servant. There's one thing that can never be taken away from us if we are sincere. And that's our desire to serve and our desire to love. That's eternal. It's our nature. Maya could cover it. But this is the fear of a devotee. Srila Prabhupada explained that you boys and girls, now when you're 70 years old, if you're 60, you're a boy or girl. I know my father, he's in his late 80s now. And my godbrother, Shyam Sundar, he's in his late 60s. And my father and Shyam Sundar Prabhu are very, very close friends, kind of best of friends. And whenever my father, when he talks about Shyam Sundar, he says, you know, that nice boy. He calls him a nice boy. Or sometimes when he calls him the young man. He's a grandfather. Yes, Shyam Sundar Prabhu is a grandfather. And compared to all of you, he's really an old man.
I compare it to my father, he's a young boy. So we see things in a very relative way. That's the nature of this world. The devotee sees everything relative to Krishna. This body, this mind, this everything. If we just recognize that it's Krishna's property, then there's no fear. No matter how much we try to control, it just never works. It cannot work. There's laws of gravity that what goes up must come down. It's a law, whether you believe it or don't believe it. However much you fight against it, it's the law. Yes? There's the laws of karma. For every action, there is an equal corresponding reaction. You can't escape it. Not on the material level. And it's a law of nature that whatever we have will be taken away soon. Our body, our family, our wealth, our property, our intellect, our skills, everything. And people become so attached, they battle, they rage war against time, trying to keep what they have, keep their youth, keep their health, keep their wealth. But you can't win. You have to be defeated because it's the law of this land. But Krishna comes again and again and again. Yada yada hi dharmasya. To remind us that you are liberated. You are free. You are full of bliss. If you just understand what is really yours. What is really yours is the bhakti, the prema, the love of your heart. That is eternally what God has given us. And nothing can take that away. But if it is covered, we forget it. And in that forgetfulness, we try to substitute these perishable illusions for the real treasure of the nature of the Atma or the soul.
Kamsa
the sufferings that he inflicted upon his sister, they did nothing against him. Ever. She never criticized him. She never spread rumors against him. She never wanted anything. She was always a loving, well-wishing sister. And he put her in chains. And worse than that, for her, she put her husband, who she loved so much, in chains. Kept them in an underground prison cell and murdered that which was most dear to her, her babies. Everyone who is a mother or father understands the attachment of a newborn child. It's like a little miracle that's just come out of your body. There's a natural, irresistible quality to that baby for the mother and child. Kamsa slaughtered them in their presence. This went on for at least 8 years. And when Yogamaya came out of his own hand when he was trying to kill the eighth child, she told him, "You are a fool. Why are you making such suffering for your sister? The child that is meant to kill you has already been born somewhere else." Kamsa had a temporary awakening that he's not the controller. He engaged in such treacherous sins to protect himself, thinking he could control his destiny from the suffering. But now he realized that no matter what he tried, it was out of his control. Kamsa, for the first time, became a little humble because he had a striking realization, it's out of my control. As long as he thought things were under his control, he continued his nefarious, murderous deeds. And he didn't even consider anything else. He was obsessed. He was infatuated. He was attached. The inertia of the way Maya works in this world is when you're riding on that wave of lust or anger or envy or greed, your whole life is moved by that wave. Kamsa wasn't thinking, should I be doing this or not? Should I keep my sister in jail or not? That fear was so much, he was just being pushed forward, controlled, like a puppet of the ego. But now, the strings were cut, and that puppet fell to the ground. And Kamsa realized all those murders, all those killings, and I could not fulfill my purpose. And then he did something which was quite extraordinary. He fell at Devaki's feet and begged forgiveness. And he cried because he felt so regretful and guilty for what he had done. Amazingly, Devaki and Vasudev, from their heart of hearts, completely forgave him. It wasn't a show. It wasn't that they were forgiving him so that their words would always be in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It was from their hearts. That's why their words are in the Srimad Bhagavatam. They forgave him. They showed love for him. They showed sympathy for him. And they even agreed with this philosophy that he said. He begged forgiveness and he cried and he said, "But actually I wasn't the doer. It was all providence, destiny." And they said, "Yes, it was destiny. You're forgiven." But they said something else, which was very powerful. These are the words of Devaki O great personality, Kamsa.
She calls him Mahabhaga. Only by the influence of ignorance does one accept the material body and bodily ego. What you have said about this philosophy is correct. Persons in the bodily concept of life, lacking self-realization, differentiate in terms of this is mine and this belongs to another. What is being said here is very interesting because it's the root of envy. This is mine and this belongs to another. As long as we're thinking in this mentality, if we have more than another, we become proud, arrogant. And if we have less than another, we are prone to envy. And we know what arrogance and envy can do to one's consciousness. They burn. So many examples. Duryodhana, he was also a prince with so much. But he was envious. He was especially envious of Bhima. And it's interesting, because Bhima wasn't even going to be the king. He was no competition in that perspective. Yudhisthira was going to be the king. The throne actually belonged to Yudhisthira Maharaj. So yes, Duryodhana envied Yudhisthira, but even more to Bhima. Because everything Duryodhana tried to do, Bhima was better. This was terrible. Duryodhana learned from Balaram how to fight with the club. But Bhima was better. And Duryodhana, he was a Kshatriya, he liked to fight. But Bhima was stronger. I guess Duryodhana liked to eat. But Bhima could eat more and not get indigestion. So Srila Prabhupada said we should eat what we need. He quotes Krishna and Gita, we should not eat too much or eat too little. He said, if you can do incredible things and not get sick, then you can eat as much as Bhima. But if you can't use that food with the strength of Bhima, Bhima didn't take big feasts and go to sleep. Bhima ate what dozens of people could eat. But then he would go out and do seva. Incredible, with such strength and power. So in every way, Bhima was just very accomplished. Duryodhana could not tolerate it. He could not tolerate anybody who had more or could do more than him. He lived in fear. He burned with envy. And envy is such a thing that it covers us over so thoroughly that we cannot even recognize who are our well-wishers. Duryodhana, Vidura, he insulted him. He kicked him out of his home. Because he thought Vidura was on the side of the people he envied.
So we can see how thoroughly envy can program us to see the whole world and anything that's connected directly or indirectly to the object of our envy becomes a threat to us. And envy is such a powerful covering that we can actually believe in the illusions and justifications that we make. If someone did a psychological study of Duryodhana, I don't think they would come to the conclusion that he felt that he was an envious liar who was cruel and duplicitous. In his own mind, I'm sure this study would find that he really believed what he was thinking. He really believed that everything should be his, although there was no logic to it. But he created a logic. He really believed that Yudhisthira was evil. And the more good Yudhisthira was, the more it was evil. Because the more good things that Yudhisthira did, the more it exposed him as being inferior. And he didn't believe he was inferior. Really an incredible personality, Duryodhana, in the way he exposes us. He went to the forest to totally insult the Pandavas. They were in exile. They had lost everything. Yudhisthira usurped literally everything that they had. And they were living as hermits in the jungle. But it wasn't enough. He went to where they were with a royal procession just to cause them pain and misery and show the world the contrast between him and Yudhisthira. He came with a royal procession to where the Pandavas were. Just to make them suffer. Just to show who you are and who I am. Just to show the world what I have achieved. And look, by my power, they're just living like hermits. Such ego. Such cruelty. He wasn't satisfied with just exiling them. He wanted to utilize that situation to make them suffer more and more and more. And ultimately, he wanted to murder them. And when that Gandharva fought against Duryodhana and defeated his armies, and Duryodhana was about to be finished, Yudhisthira Maharaj came and fought for him. And defeated the Gandharva. We had Arjuna and Bhima, Nakula, Sahadev. When Bhima got the news that Duryodhana was defeated and was captured, Yudhisthira said, "We have to go protect him." Bhima said, "My brother, protect him? It's his karma. Just let it happen. He's trying to kill us. He's taken everything away from us. He's humiliated our wife, Draupadi. He deserves it." But Yudhisthira Maharaj, he forgave Duryodhana and went to fight for him. Yudhisthira Maharaj, even though he was insulted and offended in the worst possible ways by Duryodhana, still, without any ego, he fought and protected Duryodhana's position. Was Duryodhana grateful? It made his envy even worse. This is the nature of envy. Yudhishthira's forgiving him and helping him and serving him unconditionally. And because of those good qualities, that made Duryodhana even more envious, even more hateful, even more committed to destroy the Pandavas. Whatever goodness Yudhishthira did, Duryodhana, it was like fuel to the fire of his hatred and envy. Doesn't make sense. But that's the way this world is. Envy covers us over so much. It deludes us, where we justify in our minds and actually believe what the mind's telling us. Jad Bharat told Maharaj Rahugana that there's only one enemy in the entire creation: the mind. The conditioned mind. It's our only enemy. Yudhishthira Maharaj was liberated in the forest because he was forgiving and loving. Because his mind was fixed on Krishna. And Duryodhana was constantly in fear and suffering, even though he had everything. Because of this very disease that Vasudeva and Devaki are speaking to Kamsa, thinking that this is mine and this belongs to another. Throughout history, today, it's the foundation of so much problems. War. This is my land. No, this is my land. Yes. World War II. Germany. They had their country. They had whatever. They built up their armies and marched into Poland and claimed, this is mine. They couldn't tolerate that any other country belonged to somebody else. It has to be mine. It created a war where tens and millions of people were killed. Tens and millions of children lost their parents. Wives were widowed. Bombs were exploding. Billions of dollars of property destroyed. Why? Because some people were thinking, this is mine and this belongs to another, and I want that. And it wasn't that they were thinking, I am evil. Because this envy justifies. It actually does belong to me. It's just your illusion that you are thinking it is yours. I want it. World wars on this basic principle. Conflict between brothers and brothers, sisters and sisters of the same family. Fighting. Sometimes killing each other, like Aurangzeb. These days, fighting in the courts. Hateful. This is mine and this belongs to you. No. And in the name of religion. It's not about being Hindu or Muslim or Christian or Jew or any of these. It's not about that. It's about this is mine and this belongs to another. That's all. This is my religion. And this other religion belongs to someone else. I'm right, they're wrong. Kill, murder, hate, terrorize, whatever. It's all justified on this basis of wanting to be the proprietor, the controller.
And as devotees,
we should be very careful to understand that our whole philosophy, the purpose of all the scriptures that we're studying and the verses that we memorize, the purpose of every single syllable of every name that we chant during our japa, the purpose of all the melodies of our kirtans, the purpose of every time we come together to raise our arms and cry out the holy names, the purpose of all the service that we render, the purpose of coming to the temple and worshiping Radha Gopinath or whatever Lord we're worshiping, form of the Lord. The purpose of all these things that we do is simply to remove this misconception that this is mine and this belongs to another. But we have to be patient. Kamsa represents that envy, that false sense of proprietorship, of being the controller, the enjoyer, the benefactor, and the envy that comes out from that, and the anger, and the lust, and the greed. Now, in the case of Kamsa, it's about 8 years that he was on the tirade, and then Krishna was born. And then Krishna lived in Vrindavan for another 11 years, according to Srila Prabhupada's purport. And he was so envious, he was sending demons every day to try to kill whatever babies were around, especially Krishna. So that's at least 19 years. Kamsa had his power, he had his control. But ultimately Krishna came and with one fist, Kamsa was finished. Haribo. That's all it takes for Krishna. So that Kamsa in our heart, it's not that Krishna necessarily comes immediately. It may take 19 years. May take 19 lifetimes. But Krishna will come if we take shelter sincerely. But the problem is, Maya, she knows, like that fisherman, what kind of fish to allure us. Yes? To somehow or other distract us from our real purpose. And to allow that Kamsa within us to control us. So yes, we should be fixed on the goal. We're chanting God's names every day sincerely. We're hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. We're speaking Srimad Bhagavatam. But the purpose of speaking Srimad Bhagavatam is not that I am a great speaker. The purpose of speaking Srimad Bhagavatam is to realize nothing's mine. If somebody else speaks Srimad Bhagavatam very nicely, we're very happy. Because Krishna's speaking through this person. And if somehow or other, by some inconceivable arrangement, we speak very nicely, we think we become humbled. Krishna's speaking through me. Krishna's speaking through her. Krishna's speaking through him. That's our happiness. There's no envy. Because we understand that Krishna is ultimately the controller of all controllers, the proprietor of everything, the intelligence of the intelligence, the ability of men and women. That's our purpose. Our sadhana, our study, our seva, our development of skills should not increase the infatuation that I'm the doer, which subsequently increases our arrogance and our envy. The purpose is to reduce those, to understand this, nothing is mine. Everything belongs to Krishna. Then we could be happy in every situation. Is there any questions?
That happened so fast. Maybe you can... Is there any questions?
Maharaj, as you said in the class, time is running by. We are becoming old. And death is going to take away everything from us. So, anyway, a person, when he comes into Krishna consciousness, and he cannot come to that level of highest detachment and everything belonging to Krishna, when he has been given some, so to say, a scope or some sense gratification is given to him, that okay, you go and accept household life, and it's a detour for you, and after some point of time, when the desire of sense gratification is completely nullified, again you come on the track. So that's why some years has been given to him for household life. But afterwards, he has to come back on the track. Again, that detachment attitude, again, commitment to devotional life should become more and more stronger. That is the goal of the scripture. So when it happens that when the days or that the years have been given to us, in that year itself, we don't finish our business. That means we don't at the right time, don't accept the vanprastha life the way it has been told to us. Because of that attachment is so strong in our heart that we are not able to complete that process in that stipulated time. And then the death is also coming very near. And the process is not yet completed because the anarthas have not gone from our heart. Then what is the hope for that devotee? Because he wants to see that, he wants to finish his business, but the anarthas is completely hanging around for him, and he's not able to take out that anarthas also, and the time has run away. So what is the hope for that devotee in that circumstance? Because time is going to run away. We are going to become old, we have to leave our body. So can you just tell what is the situation for that devotee in that juncture of time?
Ananda Vrindavan Prabhu. Downstairs there are beautiful trophies that were awarded to him by the Mumbai Stock Exchange as being one of the greatest consultants with the greatest integrity for giving people guidance of where to best invest their wealth. Yes? Those trophies like that. And interestingly, he gave the trophies to the temple. I think this is probably the first time in history of the Mumbai Stock Exchange that someone who got trophies for their expertise as being great consultants in the stock market. They offer their trophies to Krishna. That's better than vanaprastha. There are many vanaprasthas who are attached to their renunciation. But the varnashram system, in every stage of life, it doesn't mean we skip over something or afraid that we may die before we reach that goal. In every stage, before we make those shifts, in every stage of life, we're focused toward the goal. The psychology of this varnashram is when you're a brahmachari, when you're a grihastha, you understand philosophically, logically, and even socially that nothing is mine, everything belongs to God. And my progress in life is to the degree that I become attached to Krishna and detached from the conception of I and mine. That this is mine and this belongs to someone else. When we actually believe that everything belongs to Krishna, and we actually believe that it's all going to be taken away, and we're actually planning in course of time to even give it all away, just with that conception of the progress of where I'm heading and where I want to go, we cultivate detachment in every stage. A grihastha who's living with family, who actually understands and lives by the principle that everything in this home is Krishna's. Everything belongs to Krishna. Let me use it all accordingly. That's perfect Krishna consciousness. Take Bhaktivinod Thakur. At the end of his life, he took to the renounced order. He became a Babaji. Did he need to do that? When he was a grihastha with his 10 children and his job with the government and all of his real estate that he was under his name, he utilized everything for the welfare of humanity in the service of Krishna. Everything. And when it came to a certain stage of life, he left everything behind. Renounced. Took vow. But he was the same person with the same renunciation and the same love for God because he was focused on that alone. So the Holy Scriptures teach us very clearly this balance. It's not that we are irresponsible in our duties, in our families, in the name of renunciation. The Kurma Brahman wanted to renounce everything immediately. When Lord Chaitanya was in Kurumakshetra, the Kurma Brahman, sometimes I think Ananda Vrindavan Prabhu is the incarnation of the Kurma Brahman. He said the same thing essentially. My Lord, this family is just a source of misery and bondage, and I'm suffering due to the waves of the sufferings of material existence, so much attachment. I want to give everything up and go with you now.
Yes? This is after he offered his family and offered his home and offered everything to Lord Chaitanya. He said, it's all yours. I'm leaving it. I'm going with you. And Lord Chaitanya said, do not speak like that. You remain here. But always chant the name of Krishna. Use everything for Krishna. And whoever you meet, tell them about Krishna. And Lord Chaitanya said, and in this way, I will always be with you. And you will always be with me. And then when Lord Chaitanya left the next morning, Kurma Brahman, just like you, followed him. Even after hearing it, he heard directly from the lotus-like mouth of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, just stay home and chant Hare Krishna. And don't be attached to anything but Krishna. And do your duties nicely. Kurma Brahman left with him. And Lord Chaitanya told him, go home, I'll be with you. I will always be with you. Just follow these instructions. So these are beautiful examples. Srimad Bhagavatam is full of them. Dhruva Maharaj, what kind of yogic detachment he could... His yearning to see Krishna. He stopped eating. He stopped drinking. He stopped breathing. He stopped moving his body. And he was only 5 years old. Such intense desire. And then he saw Krishna. And Krishna sent him back and told him, get married and rule the kingdom. That was his duty. But how did he rule his kingdom? Whatever trophies he got, he gave to Krishna. Huh? And then at a certain stage in life, he went to Badrikashram, left everything behind, and just performed tapasya in the association of great rishis in the Himalayas. So the process of grihastha life isn't that we enjoy, 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 and then when I become a vanaprastha age, then I give everything up. Every stage is the door to perfection, if we do it properly. So if we're living as a proper grihastha, as Lord Chaitanya instructed Kurma Brahman, or as Dhruva Maharaj ruled the world, or as Prahlad ruled the world, or as Priyavrata ruled the world. If we do it in the right consciousness, Grihastha Ashram in and of itself is the path of perfection. But we're actually in that process. And if we do live to that certain age, then it becomes Vanaprastha. It's not really, it's natural. In one sense, we're already there. If we live grihastha life properly, we're already vanaprastha. Srila Prabhupada said that if you live as a grihastha in this spirit of being attached to chanting God's names, Krishna's names, and understanding nothing is mine, everything is the property of Krishna, and not having a false ego, that is sannyas. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, what is a sannyasi? Sannyasi is not one who lights no fire or does no work. A sannyasi who is one who works with devotion, with detachment. Srila Prabhupada, he understood it in this way. That grihasthas are as good as sannyasis if they have that spirit. And if sannyasis are attached to their renunciation, if they're envious of somebody else's renunciation, or proud of their own, that's not sannyas at all. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, Prisha Bhanu Prabhu.
Maharaj, as years roll by, there is an increasing feeling of inadequacy about following the sublime principles of Krishna consciousness and especially following the instructions of spiritual master and pleasing him. So this feeling of inadequacy sometimes gets you down and you feel that the goal is, you know, it is something of an uphill task to, you know, follow the true principles of Krishna consciousness day to day, moment to moment. So how do we deal with this kind of a feeling in our hearts?
Vyavashayatmaka budhir ekeha kuru nandana bahushaka yanantasya budhayo vyavashayanam. Krishna tells those who are on this path, they are resolute in purpose and aim is one. Dhritavrata. Determination is necessary to make proper spiritual progress. That determination, it comes through several ways. Primarily through satsang. By associating and hearing from people who have determination. Associating with sadhus. Whether they're in the stock market or in the ashram. Sadhus, people who have determination. And the choices we make nourish the various inclinations that we have. Every time we decide to perform our sadhana, to act in a way that's favorable for Krishna consciousness, to not act in ways that are unfavorable for Krishna consciousness. Every time we act properly, we are nourishing that inclination. We have so many bad habits. And even if we don't physically practice them, they're in our minds. We have so many inclinations to bad habits. And every time you give in to it, it becomes stronger. The good dog and the bad dog. But every time we choose to feed a good habit, that becomes stronger. So that is what determination means. Minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, week by week, month by month, year by year, we have a determination to nourish the good habit of overcoming this conception of I and mine by immersing ourselves in devotional service. And somehow or other saying no to the bad tendencies. A person who's given in to making the decision to smoke cigarettes, maybe smoking 60 cigarettes a day for 30 years. It's very difficult to give it up. But if we have that determination, and we somehow or other keep our minds busy doing something else, and little by little, by little, by little, as long as we keep avoiding unfavorable things by nourishing what's favorable, then those unfavorable desires are overcome. And ultimately, when actually one is making some real spiritual advancement, at that point, such a person asks the question you're asking today, in the spirit that you're asking it today. Where no matter how much we try, Maya is just too much. Yes? However much determination I have, however much desire I have, Maya is just too much. At that point, we realize we just have to surrender to Krishna. We have to have this determination ourselves. But ultimately, we just have to surrender to Krishna. And we should be happy in the process of surrendering to Krishna. Does that answer your question? Haribo. Yes, Sri Gauranga Prabhu, last question.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, the fear of losing or straining or spoiling a relationship, whether it is with a customer or with a relative or with a friend, versus doing what is right, it's a constant struggle and constant endeavor. And so how does, I mean, of course there is chanting, there is, you know, satsang, all that, but it is so difficult to do this. So how does one manage to do it?
Welcome to the material existence. You're not the only person who ever asked this question. But if we really are sincerely taking shelter of satsang, and we really are taking shelter of good sadhana, and we really are taking shelter of Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, then Krishna will give us that intelligence, moment by moment, day to day, how to balance material life and spiritual life. But if we're not actually taking shelter, if we're not actually giving the proper time and priority to what gives us that strength, then we will naturally be very much swept away by the confusion how to do it. To balance our material responsibilities with our spiritual aspirations is a great challenge. And it never gets easier on a material level. It only gets easier to the degree we become detached. The circumstance do not get easier. Sometimes devotees procrastinate. I'll actually be able to do it when it gets easier. But it only gets easier to the degree you surrender. The circumstances may not get easier. And even if they do, it's just a matter of time till they become more difficult again. It's like if you're in the ocean and you're wet and you're freezing cold, and somebody sends you a life raft, and you think, well, let me wait until it gets warmer and less wet. It's never going to happen. The complications, the implications, the challenges, the difficulties. It's just the nature of this world. We have relatives, we have customers, as you're saying, and we also want to make spiritual progress and how to deal with them, and at the same time, not lose the jewel of our bhakti in the process. It's a challenge. But if we have good satsang, and if we have good sadhana, and we're reading Prabhupada's books, and we make these things a priority, and we are sincere, then everything will be revealed to us. We shouldn't hope that the circumstances change. We should hope that we change, because that's the only solution. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Maharaj. Because actually, the problem, I suppose, is really within us. It's not outside. It's the fact that maybe we don't want to change. We're not doing what you're saying in terms of seriously following the process.
He has just summarized the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. I think we should end this class meditating on these very, very divine words of Sri Gauranga Prabhu. I thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.